It's Wednesday, December 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a high-ranking North Korean official reportedly dies in a car crash.
So I think this is actually a significant loss for the North Korean regime.
U.S. golfer Tiger Woods celebrates his 40th birthday as questions arise about his future. And we hear the music of a 12-year-old jazz pianist from Indonesia. It's... A senior North Korean official is said to have died Tuesday in a car crash. 73-year-old Kim Yong-gun, who headed the United Front Department, the agency handling relations with South Korea, was described by the KCNA state-run news agency as leader Kim Jong-un's closest comrade and a solid revolutionary partner. And he was praised for his admirable loyalty and competence. A state funeral is being planned for Thursday. In August, Kim attended talks at the border that diffused tensions over the wounding of two South Korean soldiers by a landmine. In 2009, he visited the South to attend the funeral of the late President Kim Dae-jung. He played a leading role in the 2007 summit between then-North Korean leader Kim Jong-il and South Korean President Roh Moo-hyun. The lack of details surrounding the car accident has fed speculation that Kim's death was suspicious and even intentional. But Korea analyst Sung Young Lee of Tufts University tells VOA's Victor Beatty he tends to believe the official version that this was an accident.
He carried a very soft image. When you see photos of him, he comes across as a nice guy. He wears a nice guy image. He always has a smile. But more importantly, he was a key figure in North Korea's dealings with South Korea. And also, he was recognized as a major barbarian handler. That would be North Korean parlance for someone who can deal with Americans. So I think this is actually a significant loss for the North Korean regime. Now, every time there's a report of a high-ranking North Korean figure who's died in a car accident, a traffic accident, that always conjures up images of various North Korean officials and generals who have been killed, presumably by the state, under this cover of traffic accident, going all the way back to the mid-1970s when the North Korean commander in the Korean War, Nam Il, was purportedly killed in a traffic accident, according to various North Korean defectors. General Nam was seen as a potential rival to Kim Jong-il. Now, we'll have to wait and see whether Kim Yong-gun was killed deliberately or indeed died in a car wreck. But according to North Korean reports that we've seen so far, it seems more reasonable to just take North Korea's statements at face value, because there are some very favorable expressions coming out of North Korea that the deceased was, quote, the closest comrade of dear leader Kim Jong-un. I don't think North Korea would go out of the way to paint Kim Yong-gun in that favorable light if the regime had meant to purge him.
You're reluctant to call this part of a power struggle or purge within the Communist Party.
Yes, I lean, I guess, much more on believing that this actually was an accident. Kim Yong-gun, over the years, I've noticed, was really a key figure. I've even thought that he was a key player higher up in the hierarchy than people with nominally higher positions. Kim Yong-gun seemed always to be in the spotlight in a kind of unobtrusive way. He usually sat very close, if not the closest, to Kim Jong-un at non-military events. Kim Yong-gun participated in the late August negotiations with the South Koreans. Kim Yong-gun was also among the three wise men who dramatically showed up in South Korea on the occasion of the closing ceremony of the so-called Asian Games in early October 2014. In a nutshell, Kim Yong-gun was a major player. He was recognized for his abilities to deal with South Koreans and also Americans.
That's Sun Yun Lee of Tufts University. He says in a highly unusual gesture, South Korea's unification ministry offered official condolences following news of the Kim death. He says President Park Geun-hye, in the fourth year of her single five-year term, may be trying to keep the momentum of recent improved ties going. And Lee says the Kim funeral is being planned quickly so it can occur before the anticipated annual New Year's Day address by leader Kim Jong-un, who marks his birthday on January 8th. Well, looking at social media and reaction to the death of North Korean official Kim Gang-gon, reportedly in a car crash. Bloomberg reports that the loss of the veteran policymaker on South Korea may leave a vacuum in the North Korean leadership over cross-border dealings. It quotes North Korea analysts Chung Song-chung and Seoul as saying there could be an extended suspension in inter-Korean dialogue and possibly more frigid relations. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports on Kim Yang-gong's death, saying the car crash triggers questions about the death of the man who was a close associate of leader Kim Jong-un. It notes that several other deaths of high-ranking North Korean officials in car accidents since 2003. Also trending on Twitter is hashtag Shandong, where Chinese state media say rescue workers have made contact with eight survivors at a mine that collapsed 5 days ago. Infrared cameras sent deep into the mine detected the survivors early Wednesday, according to state broadcaster CCTV, which said the workers are in stable condition. Rescuers have sent food and other supplies to the workers, the report said, but the Xinhua News Agency said rescue efforts are being complicated by the structural instability of the tunnel and falling debris. Well, another popular trend on Twitter is hashtag Zhou Enlai, named for the late Chinese premier and associate of Mao Zedong. A new book called The Secret Emotional Life of Zhou Enlai by Hong Kong journalist So Wing Mu asserts that Zhou was gay. The book says Zhou's sexual orientation could explain his distant but long-term marriage and his cautious relationship with Mao. The new theory will likely be controversial in mainland China, where homosexuality is not widely accepted. And that's social media for today. In other news, even though President Barack Obama reached historic diplomatic breakthroughs with other longtime U.S. adversaries, it's unlikely he will realize any progress to limit North Korea's nuclear program. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul.
This year, the Obama administration's persistent diplomatic outreach paved the way for normalizing relations with communist Cuba and a deal to limit Iran's nuclear program. But in North Korea, the belligerent standoff continues, now with the U.S. focused on threats from Islamic militants in the Middle East. Analysts like Professor John DeLory at Seoul's Yonsei University say there is little political will to try to deal with North Korea.
Given renewed question of how to deal with terrorism, that just bumps North Korea back down the ladder. Even though this issue is not being dealt with, and in the long term, obviously, is a huge problem for national security from a U.S. perspective.
The North's past actions, reneging on a nuclear deal in 2008 and provocations, including a 2013 nuclear test that even drew protest and sanctions from its key ally, China, has made any outreach difficult. Professor DeLory says Obama's restraint may also have been influenced by the prevailing opinion among experts that the autocratic Kim regime would not last long after the death of Kim Jong-il in 2011.
This system is not going to make it through a second transition of power. It should have gone away a long time ago. Now it's finally going to go away. And so that influenced, I think, the White House's thinking about North Korea from the get-go.
Kim Jong-un has endured and has carried on his father's belligerent and unpredictable approach with the outside world. Sanctions, travel bans, and UN efforts to prosecute human rights violations have frustrated the Kim regime. But Chung Song-chung, a North Korea analyst with the Sejong Institute, says the country's economy has improved thanks to some agricultural reforms and increased assistance from China. He says while Kim Jong-un is unsatisfied with the country's isolated status, the regime is experiencing less pain than we think from the outside. That means the North Korean problem will likely remain one that President Obama leaves to his successor. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of French researchers may have found out why we have an uncanny knack for sensing danger. When reacting to situations that pose a threat, the scientists say the brain assigns more of its processing resources than it does during less threatening circumstances. Writing in the journal eLife, the researchers say they were able to identify the particular regions of the brain that are involved in this sensation. They say the human brain can automatically sense social threats within just 200 milliseconds. Researchers say they also found that the specific regions of the brain that sense threats differ among people who are anxious and those who aren't as stressed. The study finds that being anxious can actually be helpful when recognizing threats, since regions of the brain used to process these perceptions are also responsible for getting us to take action. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we meet a 12-year-old jazz pianist. World-renowned golfer Tiger Woods turns 40 years old Wednesday amid lingering questions about his future on the professional circuit. The greatest player of his generation and arguably of all time, Woods has not won a tournament since 2013 and a major since 2008. Once the world's number one ranked golfer for nearly 700 weeks, Woods has plummeted to 414th and said in November he was in the dark about his future playing career. More recently, however, the winner of 79 PGA tournaments, including 14 majors, second only to the 18 of Jack Nicklaus, was sounding more upbeat. Posting on a blog on the PGA Tour website, he looks forward to returning to competition in 2016. Tiger Woods, plagued in recent years by personal scandal, multiple knee and back surgeries, and struggling with a new swing, acknowledged in a recent interview he's reconciled himself to not playing again. Quan Kuo is a commentator for the Golf Channel. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it would be hard for him to imagine watching golf without Tiger.
He's saying that he's a goal setter and now he had nothing to look forward to. He's the one who won 79 wins and 14 majors at 40 young age in golf. And now he's talking about he had nothing to look forward to, or he even talked about he would not sacrifice his quality of life with his children instead of going out there forcing himself playing golf and jeopardize his future life, and which kind of almost like an inner era to us, which for us, we've been seeing him when he turned pro in 97, won the Master the very first time at young age of 21, and he had really brought a game of golf across the globe pretty much because he's a mixed race and a lot of people can associate with him. I think a lot of Asian see him as an Asian and African-American see him as African-American. And basically he is just such a young prodigy, brought the game of golf to the young crowd. I mean, you look at what's going on right now, the world 1, 2, and 3, they'll watch Tiger when they're growing up. Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, and also Ricky Fowler. They all treat Tiger Woods as an idol, but time had passed almost that Tiger is just not competitive enough. And it was kind of sad when Tiger turned 40.
There are a lot of pros who have turned 40 and still had a few good years left, including Jack Nicklaus.
Yes, indeed. I mean, Jack had won the major championship after 40. And you look at Davis Love III, still very competitive in the PGA event. Freddie Couple, senior PGA event, they are still very, very active. You know, Freddie Couple got a big back as well. But Tiger, at age of 40, talking about not playing golf and nothing to look forward to, that it's just sad.
What is the future for Tiger if he decides to walk away from golf?
Well, he just recently finished his first design course in America, Blue Jack, and had the rave review. I think with his talents and his experience in playing golf and all the courses he's seen, he may be a golf architect.
That's Kwon Kwo of the Golf Channel. But Jack Nicklaus refuses to write Tiger off, calling him very focused with a great work ethic and tremendously talented. The 75-year-old Nicklaus says to count Tiger Woods out of achieving the goal of winning 18 major tournaments in his career would be foolish. And just this week, Tiger himself, when asked where he sees himself in 5 or 10 years, responded, still playing golf at the highest level and winning tournaments and major championships. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A young jazz pianist from Indonesia has developed quite a following lately, garnering rave reviews and 2 Grammy nominations for Best Improvised Jazz Solo and Best Jazz Instrumental Album. Joey Alexander is one of the youngest musicians to receive that honor, and he's 12 years old. Heidi Chang has more on Alexander's journey to America, the birthplace of jazz.
When people first hear Joey Alexander play the piano, they are moved by his virtuosity and a bit surprised when they learn he's only 12. But don't think about his age, says Jason Olain, who produced Joey's debut album.
Just close your eyes and listen to Joey.
Josiah Alexander Sila was born in Bali, Indonesia, where his parents ran a travel business.
Well, my dad played a little bit of piano and guitar, but not that professionally. And then I saw him play, and he make me like, I want to play. Feels me like, I want to try this instrument.
When Joey was 6 years old, he learned to play jazz by ear, just by listening to his dad's record collection.
Duke Ellington and all these greats, Billy Strayhorn, Thelonious Monk, and Miles Davis, Coltrane, and Bill Evans. You know, I hope I hear all of these amazing musicians.
Joey's family moved to Jakarta so he could play with some of Indonesia's best jazz artists. When he was 10, he was invited to New York to play at Jazz at Lincoln Center, where Jason Olain is director of programming. Olain remembers the reaction of musicians who were there for a rehearsal when Joey performed a Thelonious Monk tune.
And Joey plays a version of Around Midnight, and everybody's like jaws dropped, like looking at Joey, like, I can't, and leaning forward and looking at each other, and they're like laughing, like this can't possibly be what we're hearing. He took another take afterwards, and it was a completely different arrangement. And again, everyone starts, you kind of shrug your shoulders, look at each other, scratch your head, and just go, okay, all right, I've never seen this before.
One of the musicians who plays on Joey's debut album is drummer Ulysses Owens Jr. He's 32. Despite their age difference, Owens says they connected musically from the start.
You know, he has this thing that he does, you know, when he's really going somewhere. And I was just like, this is freaking amazing. You know, like watching this little kid, he's going on all this heart, you know, all these harmonic adventures and melodic adventures and, you know, doing some really hip stuff. And he's just gone. You know, he's just completely in this next stratosphere. I'm like, that is a gift, man. You know, when I opened my eyes and I would look at him, that's what I saw. I was like, man, this kid is literally from another planet. And it's so beautiful to watch.
The young pianist is homeschooled. He likes pop music, Michael Jackson, Aretha Franklin, and the Beatles.
You know, I'm still me as a kid, playing toys, and I play sports. Like, I play a little bit of tennis, swimming, like a normal kid, and then I watch movies.
Joey Alexander's parents gave up their travel business and eventually moved the family to New Jersey so Joey could pursue music. He says he's grateful for all the support and encouragement he's received along the way. And he's thrilled to be a part of the New York City jazz scene, where so many of his idols first made those recordings he grew up hearing, and where he can live his dream playing jazz for people.
I hope that they will feel the joy, because this music is so joyful and it touches people's hearts. And that's why, you know, when I play, I always hope, you know, people will, you know, be joyful, you know, in their lives and to have hope.
For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang.
I think he's got quite a future ahead of him. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One thing is for certain. As our collective populations grow, so will our need for energy. And just as surely, as we ramp up energy production, wherever possible, we must turn to production that is clean and sustainable. Today's global population is about 7.3 billion people. Of these, millions are underserved, and about 1 billion have no access at all to electricity. So, given that the population will expand to some 9 billion by the year 2050, in order to accommodate the needs of another 3 billion people, our energy output will need to increase by at least 80%. Even in the short term, the numbers are staggering. As Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, said recently, in just the next 15 years, we can expect the world will add more than 5,500 gigawatts of electricity capacity. This is the equivalent of adding all the power generation that exists in the world today. At the same time, we need to also reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the energy sector by 60% to 80% to address global climate change. One of the most promising technological advances in energy production is distributed energy systems, including off-grid solutions, such as power generators and solar panels, said Undersecretary Novelli. And because low-carbon technologies, such as solar panels, will be easier to acquire and cheaper to run than fossil fuel technologies, she said, the vast majority of those new connections will come from renewable energy sources. The United States has recently committed to providing access to off-grid clean energy products and services to more than 500 million people by 2020. This includes a $75 million loan guarantee from USAID's Power Africa program to scale up off-grid renewable investments in sub-Saharan Africa, $20 million in loans from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for supporting residential solar in Kenya and Nigeria, and $46 million from the Millennial Challenge Corporation for off-grid electrification in Benin. When it comes to energy, our goal is to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, clean energy for all by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.